This is R.J. Rushdoony, easy chair number 175, July the 18th, 1988. Tonight, Otto and myself have with us Gary Mose to help us with the interviewing and one of our staff members, Sam Blumenfeld. Sam Blumenfeld has been traveling back and forth across the United States, speaking on Christian education, homeschooling and formal Christian schools. If he hasn't been to your neighborhood, just wait, he'll be there. I think he's covered more communities in the United States in recent years than almost any other man living. As a matter of fact, I continually get letters from you saying that you heard Sam Blumenfeld speak in your community, and he was wonderful. Welcome, Sam. It's good to have you with us tonight.
It's nice to be with you, Rush.
What's happening on the homeschooling front right now?
Well, you know, since I was last with you, it's about 2 years, a great deal has happened. The homeschooling movement has grown leaps and bounds. As a matter of fact, only a couple of weeks ago, I believe, in Southern California, the California Homeschool Association had its convention, and 15,000 people showed up. That was at Disneyland Hotel. So if that's a sign of the times, it's a very good sign that parents are finally doing what they've had to do all these years, and that is remove their children from the public schools, mm-hmm. from humanist education, and they're deciding to educate their children at home. Some of these children do come out of Christian schools also, but I believe that that's not all bad, because the homeschool movement and the Christian schools are going to have to collaborate and work together
yes.
in this area.
Well, this noon, I had a telephone call from John Lofton, and he was telling me that we are being the subject of some verbal criticism in the media. And one or two of the statements, at least, referred to the fact that in the 50s, an aesthetic Catholicism was made popular by Buckley and Kirk. Then born-again Christianity, fundamentalistic and Arminian, dispensational, free mill, came in with the 70s. And now, a very dangerous group known as the Christian Reconstructionists have arrived on the scene, and we were mentioned by name. And it well may be because of what we're doing that the great issue of the next decade will be the public schools' fight for survival.
Oh, yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, Rush, the title of my talk, my lecture that I've been giving for the last year or so is, Are the Public Schools Harming Your Children? Mm-hmm. And I proved to the audience beyond a shadow of a doubt that the children are at risk in four significant ways. They're at risk academically because of the methodology used in the schools, the method of teaching reading, which produces functional literacy. They're at risk spiritually because the public schools are doing everything in their power to destroy the Christian faith of children through such programs as values clarification and sensitivity training and situational ethics and multiculturalism and globalism and sex education and evolution and death education. Then the children are at risk morally because of the kind of peer interaction. Who does the child meet in the public schools but the drug pushers and the drug users and the sexually active, the blasphemers, the users of foul language? That certainly is not a very good atmosphere for a youngster to be brought up in. And then, of course, there's also the physical danger, because public schools have become dangerous places. Kids are coming yes. to school with guns and knives and chains, and Children are being assaulted and robbed and even murdered. Teachers are being murdered. Principals are being murdered. So the public school is a very dangerous place for a child. And when I get through with my talk, generally the parents decide to remove their children from the public schools. They realize that the risks are much too great. The children are, if they're precious enough, if they really love them, they're not going to subject them to those horrible risks.
Well, we have one of the real pioneers of the battle against the public schools with us, Otto Scott, who still has, isn't it true, Otto, the all-time record for truancy in New York City?
As far as I know, yes. It was the 7 months of successful truancy. Because I had two report cards, one real and one false. I presented my dad the false one. I went in the room every night to do my homework, and I read books, trashy books. And I wrote letters saying I was ill, and some teacher finally became concerned and came over to see us. And that, of course, exposed me. Incidentally, they almost sent me away until I was 21 for that. And I was saved by Justice Levy of the Children's Court in those days. And he said to the man who made the recommendation, if you make another recommendation of this sort, I will see to it that you lose your job.
Mm.
And he and I corresponded for several years after that. He was a very interesting man. But in bringing the thing up to date, and of course the reason that I played hooky in New York City schools, it was the only long period of public schools that I had outside of the little school up in my grandparents' village. And I couldn't stand the bells and the different classrooms, running between the classrooms and the fellows with mustaches playing handball in the courtyard who were blocked in the sixth grade for 4 years running and all that. And the teacher had a chart with our names on it, and if you put your hand up, she'd look at the chart to see who you were, all that. And I wasn't learning anything. And I had the instincts of a scholar. Now, more recently, I've begun to do some reading, not so much in educational subjects, because they've never really interested me. I'm not too fond of young people, and I would never be a good teacher, I'm sure. I'd be a terrible teacher. Because I don't learn anything when I'm talking anyway. But I have recently remembered Spengler, who said that modern education is poorly based. It is an attempt to pour new wine into old bottles.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches, for instance, algebra and geometry, trigonometry and physics, to people who are not going into any of the engineering sciences and who have absolutely no need for these particular subjects. They may be totally alien to them, to their instincts, to their potential, to their talent. There's no reason to teach them across the board to a modern audience, because we're no longer operating a technology based on measurements. And how to figure out an isosceles triangle is a very esoteric thing for anyone who isn't an engineer. And in similar manner, we have stopped looking at the fundamentals of what constitutes an education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this, somewhere down the line, is going to have to be addressed, because even the Christian school movement and the homeschool movement is under tremendous pressure to fit more or less into the framework set up by the official educators.
Okay.
And we know that the SAT tests and all the rest of it are based upon postulants, upon premises that have not been examined for 700-800 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, the remarkable thing that is going on in the homeschooling movement, Otto and Rush, is that there is this examination going on as to what to teach, what is important. Of course, there concerned about keeping the state off their backs,
mm-hmm.
and everyone realizes you've got to impart literacy, you've got to teach the basics, the mm-hmm. basic tools of learning. But apart from that, there is a good deal of discussion going on in what constitutes true education. For the last day, I was never good at math, never cared for it.
Neither did I.
But for the last day, I've been reading a marvelous manuscript on the relationship of mathematics to religion.
By James Nicholson.
Right. As a manifestation, as a means of understanding God's word by seeing the patterns in nature. And what mathematics, if you study mathematics under that kind of a point of view, that is from a godly point of view, suddenly mathematics makes sense because it enables you to see so many invisible things in nature, things that are not visible to the eye, but which you see patterns, and that's a remarkable insight that this particular manuscript gave me just reading that. So I suddenly my interest in mathematics was quickened, and I thought, if I had been taught mathematics this way from the very beginning, from a God-centered point of view, as a means of knowing God's world, God's creation, I would have taken to it.
Of course you would, because it's poetic. But the way education has been fixed for a long time has been that science is facts, religion is fiction, science is objective, art, music, religion is subjective, and what is subjective cannot be evaluated, cannot be measured, cannot be weighed, cannot be proven, and therefore is unscientific and an embarrassment, and only technology is valid.
Let me just interject that we are going to publish this manuscript by James Nichol on God and mathematics. Gary, you have a very practical involvement in Christian education, both through our Christian school and the fact that Graham is being homeschooled for high school. Any comments and observations?
Well, I have something I'd like to explore with Sam along this line. You mentioned at the beginning of our discussion that there's going to have to be cooperation between Christian schools and homeschools. I am a co-founder of a Christian school, and as Russ just mentioned, my wife and I are homeschooling one of our children. I have homeschooled two other ones in the past. And I'm starting to get reports just in recent months about tensions developing between Christian schools and homeschooling families, particularly in churches which have started Christian schools in recent years and are now are experiencing a number of their families pulling out of the Christian schools and homeschooling. In what ways do you think that Christian schools and families in homeschools can cooperate, some practical ways in which they could cooperate?
Well, in the first place, the Christian school can act as an umbrella, in other words, to provide some legal protection for the homeschoolers as simply having them enrolled. That's one practical thing they can do. Also, Christian schools can offer certain extracurricular activities, music, band, the kind of activities that require group support, and some homeschoolers don't feel particularly able to teach highly technical subjects, chemistry labs and that sort of thing. But also another important thing that the Christian school should realize is that while some families homeschool their children, K through 12, if you want to use those numbers, there are many homeschoolers who reach a point where they do want to put the child in a formal atmosphere. And if the Christian school has been friendly to the family, they're more likely to go to that school than one that has been hostile. So it's in the interest of the Christian school to befriend the homeschoolers, in the interest of someday getting some of those children back, from an economic point of view. But they have to collaborate because we're all part of the same movement. You see, it's the same battle against a secular humanist education. We're just doing it different ways. And remember, the Bible has given parents the responsibility for educating their children. As a matter of fact, the Bible commands parents to educate their children. So the parent has the first responsibility. If that parent wants to delegate that responsibility to a Christian school, fine. But if that parent wants to do it themselves, those parents want to do it themselves, they certainly should be supported by the Christian community.
Isn't there a point, Sam, where parents are beginning to run into a sort of a dead end? Well, you get through high school, for instance. Then what? You don't want to send the child to a seminary, yes, which is a continuation of a Christian education, or a Bible school. And there aren't very many colleges, so far as I know. Well, of course, there are Catholic colleges, and I don't know whether there are any Protestant colleges left at all.
Well, there are a large number of Protestant colleges, but the question is how many of them are worth much. Mm-hmm. So many have departed from the faith, and increasingly both Catholic and Protestant colleges are so enamored of accreditation that they're ready to sell their soul to the devil. I think perhaps one area of great potential for the future is the kind of thing that Valley Christian was doing. Because here was a largely correspondence program with some on-campus instruction and examination regularly. And it was enabling a great many people, particularly older ones who were going back and trying to do their educating without surrendering their jobs and taking care of their families at the same time. And the results were exceptionally good. The graduates were a distinguished group until the state intervened there. Now, I think something like that may well develop within the next generation. The modern university is making itself obsolete. It has become increasingly power-oriented. The number of departments, the endless division to create new power centers, so that you no longer are being trained in a department in terms of an actual vocation. You're being trained in terms of faculty's idea of courses that will build up its prestige and give it more power on campus by having more students.
Yes, if you choose a major, I understand.
Yes.
If you choose a major, then they give you certain mandatory courses that you have to take, which are often very far afield mm-hmm. from your major. And that means that at least half your time is spent in courses that you don't intend to pursue, have no particular interest in.
Well, you know, I believe that the university today has merely become a credentialing system. In other words, you go there to get a diploma.
Which is a union card.
Yeah.
It's
to become a lawyer or
right.
a doctor. That's all it is. You've got to go through it to get these pieces of paper that provide you with access to certain professions. Otherwise, you're left out.
You can't even be interviewed in the average corporation without a degree.
Exactly. I know brilliant people who would make wonderful lawyers, but they can't practice law because they don't have that sheepskin. And so,
interesting, the jailhouse lawyers are among the best in the country.
Well, you know, you used to be able to go to law school for 2 years
mm-hmm.
and if you passed the bar examination, that was it. But now they insist on 4 years of college first and then 2 years.
Yes.
Except in California. In California, you can simply prepare on your own and take the bar examination.
There's a problem, though. Only about 15 to 20% of the applicants for the bar examination ever pass, for reasons that are quite mysterious.
Well, one of the more prominent corporation lawyers in this state, who recently retired, passed the bar examination that way.
Mm-hmm. Rush, I'm often asked by parents, as a matter of fact, if I can recommend a decent college for their youngsters. And I generally tell them that, you know, that Hillsdale is not bad. It's pretty good, has a good reputation. Then there's Grove City.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want a very strong traditionalist religious education, there's Bob Jones University, which is really, when you go down there, it's almost like going back to the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The girls wear skirts, and the boys wear pants and ties and shirts, and everything is done by the numbers, but it's a different atmosphere. So there are some colleges and universities, and I feel, though, that and particularly the military schools, the academies.
Mm.
We've had homeschoolers who have gotten scholarships to Annapolis and become officers in the military. So it isn't entirely hopeless.
Oh, no. But I think it's a subject that's going to have to... It's becoming increasingly important.
Yes. Yes.
As the Christian and homeschool graduates increase, we're now getting into the business of adult schooling.
Yes, yes.
That's the next big breakthrough.
Well, at the beginning of the 70s, everybody was wondering what they were going to do for Christian high schools. Now they have exceptionally fine homeschool materials,
mm-hmm.
and the Christian schools have moved into that area. As a matter of fact, you can get video cassettes to teach your high school student at home, which will give you better material in, say, chemistry or physics than you can get in almost any school in the country. So the homeschoolers have suddenly forged ahead in that area because of the modern technology.
Well, of course, the thing about a homeschool or a small Christian school is that you can't hide. And in public school, there's a great deal of, in effect, working anonymity.
Yeah.
Well, I
simply wanted to second that the point about technology in the home, that the home now has access to computers and video machines, VHS and cassettes. And as you know, Otto, education is, the educated people are self-taught.
Oh, well, you have to be, yes.
And it depends 95% on reading.
Oh, of course.
95% comes out of reading, and the
right.
5% is experience. So books are available, tapes are available, lectures are available. So much can be done at home, you know, rather than sitting in a lecture hall listening to some professor put you to sleep. I mean, that's not my idea of education.
That was clearly the case with our son, who just completed his junior year of high school as a homeschooler. He's gone all the way through his junior high, almost all the way through junior high, and all the way through high school as a homeschooler. And in the early years, my wife worked very intensely with him as a monitor and a teacher. This past year, as a junior, he has worked almost entirely on an individual basis. Reading, individual research, he's working on a much more intensive level than I ever did all the way through college. He dreams up his own research activities, and he follows through on that, and he's just completed his college entrance test, first round, and came out in the 99th percentile. So from my own experience, I can vouch for the fact that it's possible for a homeschooler to achieve very highly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the great advantages of the homeschool and the Christian school is the lack of money.
Oh, yeah.
Because some years ago, almost 20 years ago, a man in the sciences told me that the curse of the public schools was the money they had to spend. So that, for example, in the sciences, they had laboratories, and they had microscopes, they had experiments to do, and so on, or so-called experiments, really repeating the experiment of someone generations ago. And he said all that was a waste of time and money, that if some experiment needed to be demonstrated to the students, the teacher could do it. But the time could be better spent and more cheaply. So he said the money the public schools have was a major hindrance to science education. And a Christian school and the home school, not having money to spend on all that paraphernalia, can concentrate on learning, not playing games with microscopes and test tubes and the like.
Well, watching films, I'm told, takes up an awful lot of public school time. Watching movies.
Sitting in the dark in classrooms watching movies.
Watching movies.
Puts you to sleep. But you're right about the business of the money doing so much damage to education. As a matter of fact, in Boston, we've had this so-called a compact between large universities and the public schools, and MIT was engaged in trying to help create a technical high school, and invested it, and this high school got a tremendous amount of free computers. They had a marvelous computer room, which hasn't been used for the last 3 years because they can't find the software, or it's just, you know, they get all this marvelous equipment, they don't know what to do with it. They don't even know how to use it, you see. And so MIT has bowed out. They've thrown up their hands with disgust, in disgust, said we can't even deal with these people.
Well, you do run into people who have excellent schooling, I do, and they're quite thrown when you tell them something the school hadn't prepared them to hear. I had a fellow working on a magazine who came from England, and I said, I want you to go out and interview, pick out five or six men in some industry or another, and ask them about this particular set of developments, which I had just happened to notice. So he went out, and he came back about 3 or 4 hours later, and I said, "Where? Who did you talk to?" He said, "Well, I went to the library." I said, "The library?" I said, "The library is a cemetery of information." I said, "Everything in the library is 15 years old. I wanted you to talk to people in the business." And he was quite offended. He said, "Well, I was never told before that it was a waste of time to go to a library." I said, "You haven't been a reporter."
Yeah. Well, it's an entirely different thing, but that's one of, I remember, I know a homeschooling family in New Orleans, and their son is very much interested in astronomy, and he wanted to meet the professor who had discovered one of the planets. And this professor happened to be living, I believe, in Arizona or New Mexico, and so the family took this trip across country and stopped off at this professor's home and actually visited with the man who had discovered the planet. The professor was delighted to see this young man because he had been long forgotten by his colleagues. You know, he was in retirement and all of that. But that's the kind of thing that you can do in homeschooling, and that's the kind of thing that homeschooling encourages, this independent search for knowledge instead of being a passive recipient of some professor or some teacher's
drinking at stale pools.
Yes, that's about it.
Well, don't encourage too much of that. One of the things that I detest is having letters and phone calls from all over the country from students in colleges and universities and sometimes Christian schools who want me to outline and sometimes send them about 10 pages on a project they're working on.
They want you to do their work.
Yes.
I know letters like that too.
I had one young woman from the University of Colorado call me and tell me she wanted to do a paper on my ideas on education. And she hadn't read my three books on the subject, but she wanted me to send her an outline of about 10 pages. And when I said no, she told me what she thought of me, how unchristian I was, and banged the receiver down.
Oh, my.
Now, that's the kind of thing that is taking place. They're parasites.
You're perfectly right. I get letters like that from people who want you to do their work for them. And they've got to realize that they have to do the work themselves.
The fun isn't doing the work.
Yes. And these people today want things handed to them and feel there's something wrong with you if you don't.
And they usually come out of the public schools.
Oh, yes.
You know, they're the ones who have been preparing all of these outlines, you see, or being told that they should have somebody else do it for them.
I've encountered instances of public school teachers who encourage people to write for data from an organization which will tell them everything they want to know. Now, as we continue, Sam, I'd like to call attention to something that our oldest daughter, Rebecca, told us just a few weeks ago when she was here with her husband and children visiting. She said that the local grade school had a principal who made no bones about the fact that she was hoping the school would continue to drift downward in its academic performance, because then they would qualify for all kinds of special federal and state funds for schools that were dealing with children who were not performing and so on. So it would appear that our public schools reward a lack of performance rather than performance.
Yeah, that's true, Rush, because the federal funding goes to the schools that fail. The more failure you have, the more money you get. So there's a built-in economic incentive now for failure in the public schools. And that's one of the reasons why they're not interested in methods that work. That's one of the reasons why you can't get systematic intensive phonics in the first grade of the schools, because they don't want the kids to be able to read well. As a matter of fact, I've heard from teachers who have used phonics, intensive phonics, in their classrooms, who were accused by the other teachers as trying to undermine the school's financial base by threatening jobs, you know, special education jobs, by producing kids who can read, you see. As a matter of fact, Rush, we now have a whole industry, a whole profession devoted to taking care of failures. It's called special education, and the largest segment of children in special ed these days are not the deaf kids or the blind kids, but the so-called learning disabled. These are children who become functionally illiterate in the first grade because of the look, say, whole word method that produces the symptoms of dyslexia. And we've known this since 1929, when Dr. Samuel T. Orton wrote an article in the Journal of Educational Psychology in which he warned the professors that this sight word method of teaching reading would produce reading disability. And of course, they didn't care what he said. They just went on their merry way.
2 years ago, two days ago, and we were at that picnic.
Yes,
the Calcedon barbecue in San Jose.
I was asked by a young woman if there was any other way to teach a child to read excepting through phonics. And I said I didn't know, but I suggested she ask you. Mm-hmm. Did she get to you?
I don't believe she did, but that's the only way you can teach a child to read an alphabetic writing system. Ours is an alphabetic writing system, and an alphabet, as you know, is a set of letters that stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language. And for generations, it was taught in a very simple mechanical way. You would teach the child first to recognize the letters of the alphabet, then you would drill the child in the sounds that the letters stood for, and the purpose of the drill was to make sure that the child developed an automatic association between letter and sound, so that when the child saw the sound, he would hear the letter. He would saw the letter, he would hear the sounds, and once you achieve that, then the child would be given words and sentences and little stories to read. So that's a three-part system, three stages. Now, the look-say method teaches the child to recognize the letters, but then skips step two, does not teach the letter sounds, and goes directly to whole words and teaches the child to look at these words as little pictures, as little ideographs, to be memorized as a sight vocabulary. And it is that attempt to memorize sight vocabulary, to deal with words as wholes, that produce the symptoms of dyslexia. Because the child is asked to look at an English word as a little picture. Well, as you know, Otto, when you look at a picture, you don't necessarily look at it from left to right or from right to left. You look at it any way you want to. And so these child develop these terrible habits of looking words in all sorts of ways, including upside down. And so these child wind up guessing what these words are and developing all these horrible habits of looking at words and mixing up letters and reversing letters and all of that. And these are considered the symptoms of dyslexia.
Mm-hmm. Now, some get through, apparently. They get high marks.
They tend to learn the phonic system on their own or with help from their parents.
I see.
Yes.
There's a lot of that going on. It's bootlegged education.
Bootlegged, black market education.
That's right. That's right.
You know, an interesting thought here. Since state education rewards incompetence, puts more money in a school, the worse it is. What if the church is operated that way?
Turn out sinners?
Yes, the more sinners they turned out and the more people they sent to hell, greater the prestige of the church and of the pastor.
Well, do you think that's not happening? Haven't you read about the homosexual denomination?
Yes. And some of our major mainline churches with their modernism, they're rewarding the same kind of thing. Of course, it's not with our tax money, at least.
Yes. But there is such a thing as a Church of Satan. I've seen it on television.
I haven't seen it on television. The argument continues to be made by some Christians that if Christians continue to pull out of the public schools, we can only expect them to get worse. The idea is that Christians are to be salt and light in every institution, every part of society. And to some extent, we make that argument in Christian Reconstruction. Christians ought not to be pulling out of various spheres because that just leaves the field to the devil. What's your response to that?
Well, my response to that is that the secular public school was created to get God out of education. That was its primary purpose. That's why the government got involved in creating or in supporting a secular public education. If you study the history of how the government got involved in the education business, you will find that the movement, the public school movement, was spurred by the Unitarians, who no longer believed in the divinity of Christ, who no longer believed in the efficacy of salvation through Christ. They believed that the school, the secular school, was to be the new vehicle of salvation. And then the Unitarians were then joined by the Owenite Socialists, who were atheists. They were in turn joined by the Hegelians, who had their pantheistic view of things. And finally, they were joined by Orthodox Christians, Protestants, who were frightened of the Catholic influx in this country and thought that perhaps they, by joining the others in a public school movement, that they could maintain the Protestant character of American culture in the face of massive Catholic immigration. Now, the Catholics saw through all of this, bolted the system, and created their own parochial school system because they didn't want their children to be either proselytized into Protestantism or turned into infidels. And that's why we have the system that we have today. So the public school system can never serve the educational and spiritual needs of Christian children.
Is it redeemable?
No, absolutely not.
Well, don't forget that he started off with the dangers of public schools today. Right. Now, one of the things that got me in trouble as a boy was the nature of the public school in New York City. I was sent to what they call junior high school. You go from the sixth grade to junior high school.
Right.
Now, the sixth grade was up in Washington Heights at the time when there was no apartment buildings up there, just one or two brand new apartments, which was rather fancy in those days. And then I was sent to this very crowded 186, which was a junior high, or which went into junior high. And where I had never played hooky excepting occasionally before, it turned me into a total and incorrigible truant. And it led to a whole series of difficulties that I got into as a boy. That particular public school experiment. And not only at that time, but since, I have heard liberals say, well, the public school is a democratic experience. And you learn to live with other races and other groups. Well, I don't know how you can escape other races and other groups in the United States in the first place,
yeah.
Or in life. It's going to happen to you as soon as you leave home anyway, even if you are born and raised in an ivory tower. But in the meantime, I venture to believe that more kids have been destroyed by the public school system than any other single institution.
Oh, you're absolutely correct on that. I just wanted to mention one other thing. You had a miserable experience in junior high, so did I. In our junior high school, they had something called an open-air class. It was in the corner of the building, in which all of the windows were kept wide open in the middle of February. The theory was that if you were underweight, you needed a lot of fresh air. And they had a recruit...
To cure tuberculosis
right.
In those days.
And they had to recruit kids for the open-air class. And they went to my mother and they told her that I was underweight and that I should be put in the open-air class. And so my mother, being an immigrant woman, didn't know what was going on, agreed. And so I was put in this horrible open-air class. I froze to death. It was filled with delinquents, about 10 of us there. The teacher was horrible. And that was the time when I began to play hooky.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
I was so miserable.
Cause and effect.
Right. Exactly.
You spoke, Gary, of sending children. I hear this all the time, and it infuriates me, into the public schools to be sought.
Right.
Now, that is an evil idea, and you tell people when they say it, they are evil. Because our Lord says to his disciples, mature men, ye are the salt of the earth. He doesn't say it to children.
Right.
Children are to be protected and nurtured, not to be sent out. We think Iran is very ugly and evil because it's sending boys of 9, 10, 11 into the front lines with guns that are bigger than they are to die. It's the same thing, only it's more brutal to send them into the public schools to have their lives blasted.
Well, this is a totalitarian practice.
Yes.
They experiment with children, and you notice that they always trot out the very smallest children.
Yes.
They don't trot out the adolescents. They trot out the 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 year olds, and then suddenly you don't hear anything more about it until you see the perfectly conformed a university type.
They also say, some of these parents, and they infuriate me, so I've reached the point where I can't talk to them without getting very angry. They say, my child can be a witness in the school. And one woman never spoke to me again because I told her, what kind of witness do you have? I've never seen a witness come out of you that was anything remotely godly.
And what they're saying is that they're going to send little lambs into the wolf pack to somehow convert the wolves.
Yes. And maintain their standard of living without having to pay for Christian schooling.
Right.
That's the key factor.
You know, you cannot really take these different levels of intelligence either and treat them as interchangeable integers. Some children grow up later than others. Mm-hmm. Some mature quickly. There are racial differences which are not simply matters of pigment. They're cultural differences. All of these things are extremely important, and to disrupt them into some sort of universal mold, a Procrustean bed, which everyone is forced to fit, has destroyed probably more minds in this country than poverty or anything else.
Yes. Another thing that the public schools do is that they create a teenage rebellion because they're teaching a different set of values through values clarification. They're telling the youngsters that they don't have to, conform to or obey their parents' values or traditions, that they can create their own. And this tends to create a conflict within the family, and you get this thing called teenage rebellion in America, which is considered very normal.
And it doesn't exist anywhere else.
Well, it certainly doesn't exist in the homeschooling family, where the families are integrated. That is, the children and the adults, the parents' lives are integrated. Whereas in the public school, the children are sent off to the school where they have their social life with their peers, they develop their friendships, their loyalties with their peers, and the parents develop their own interests. You know, they play bridge or they go on a cruise, and the kids are left to their devices, and you get a separation and a parting of the ways. Whereas in a homeschooling, you have an integrated family where everybody is interested in one another. The children are part of their parents' lives, the parents are part of their children's lives, and that makes for a healthier family.
Well, to clarify that a little further, that's not to say that in a homeschooling family there may not be conflict.
And oh, sure.
If I may use my own family as an example, I'm here to tell you that we've had plenty
of conflict.
The difference is, though, that we're not at cross purposes. The purpose of each individual member in the family is in the same direction, and it's not rebellion in that sense, because our purpose is common.
Yes.
Even though we may, have daily conflicts or conflicts over minor technical matters or personalities, our purpose in life, the goal to glorify God and to reclaim this world for our King, all of our children share that value with us as parents. So conflicts are resolvable then, because we have a common purpose.
Yes.
There is, I recall some years ago, I told you about the conference, that youth conference I attended, because I was doing a project for the council, I think it was, on employment of youth, which had grown out of the Child Labor Committee. And so for a while I was on the fringes of the educational establishment. And I remember attending a fairly well collection, pretty big collection of teachers, in which a number of them very proudly said, "I am not interested in the bright, I am interested in the disadvantaged." And I thought, a teacher that is not interested in the bright is some sort of intellectual pervert. Because the whole point in teaching is to discover and encourage the potential of the bright. What sort of a society can exist by taking care of its dullards at the expense of its brilliant?
There is another aspect to the whole subject of education, and it is this. In a home school, the parents are concerned with the whole life of the child, and with educating the child in terms of the faith, in terms of his aptitudes, in terms of a knowledge of the weaknesses of the child. And you recognize yourself and your children, and so you know what to watch out for, where to clobber them.
It's humiliating, but
yes, it's. Now, in a Christian school, because you as a Christian have certain goals, the school shares those goals with you and watches over the child in the same way. But you have that same parental concern in a public school by people who have a totally alien faith, a totally alien goal for your children. So it leads to the warping of the child, and it's a fundamental disrespect for the child and for the family of the child. And it results in a very wooden thing that they're going to force on all the children to make them into cookie-cutter peoples. I recall some few years ago when they learned something that took them a while to learn. And it was this. Maybe you remember, Otto, our generation, and maybe yours, Sam. When you went to school, you had to have a glass of milk every day.
Oh, yes.
Yes. It was brought around and handed to every child, and you had to drink it up. I always liked milk. It was no problem. I could drink mine and the next kid's if he didn't want it, and I could get away with it. But there were some children who didn't like it.
Yes.
And it took some while for them to learn, many years of sad experience, that a very high percentage of black children and a substantial percentage of white children are, after the early 2-3 years of their life, allergic to milk. It makes them bilious and gassy and miserable.
That's right.
And there were a lot of them, I remember, like that. I didn't know the reason for it, but they were all around me in school. Well, that was the state school. It was going to ram its pattern down the throat of all children without exception.
Rush, let me relate a humorous aspect of that business of certain black children being allergic to milk. Jesse Jackson and his wife were invited by Michael Dukakis for a 4th of July dinner. And the first course of the meal was clam chowder with milk. And Jesse had to pass it up. He couldn't eat the clam chowder because of the milk. He was allergic to milk. And so that there went the first course. The second course was salmon and peas, which is a traditional New England, you know, 4th of July dinner. Well, of course, Jesse only eats fried fish. So that course went by the meal. Finally, when they adjourned to, when it was all over, and they adjourned to the esplanade where the concert was being played, Jesse had a TV dinner brought, I don't know if it was a TV dinner, but a fast food dinner brought into him on a plastic plate. He was so hungry.
No wonder he's
That's
not happy with Dukakis.
No wonder they didn't get on the ticket.
That's the kind of thing that they really don't think about when they're dealing with the
youngsters. When I first went to school, they used to skip grades.
Yes.
I skipped several grades. But I understand now they don't skip grades.
No. Yes. And they don't flunk.
And they don't
many,
flunk.
Many, many schools across
the country. Therefore, the marks mean nothing.
No.
The grades mean nothing.
Yes.
And even if you have a 99 percentile, it doesn't mean that you're going to be admitted to any school you apply to.
You know, another thing, Rush, is that the public schools have actually become anti-Christian.
Yes.
They're not neutral, as you know. They pretend
never
to be neutral.
Been.
Yeah, they never have. But they are so anti-Christian that I'm sure you're aware of the case on this equal access, where the extracurricular clubs, Bible clubs, have been banned on campus. And, of course, Congress passed the Equal Access Law in order to give the schools the ability to, that is, the permission to permit Bible study clubs. Well, the schools now show their true color by saying, well, we can't have a Bible study club because the Bible is not relevant to the curriculum. We can only have extracurricular activities that are relevant to the curriculum. So, yes, you can have a chess club because it's relevant to logic and mathematics, but
Bible study is not relevant to anything. Can you imagine the Bible not being relevant to what is going on in the school? Well, the most important single book in all of...
Not relevant to a barbarian.
That's about it.
But I was in a trial in the cell in which that was the issue. Since the children were being bussed in from miles and miles around, some got in about 35, 40 minutes ahead because the same buses had to make several routes. They made the route so that some got in much ahead of the others, and they started a Bible study group, met in a classroom, and all hell broke loose. They were taken to court and lost.
And they lost.
Yes.
And my heavens, the Bible is, you know...
The font of our civilization.
Not only the font of our civilization. Go ahead.
Yes, there was an elderly black woman who was in the courtroom. A teacher had taught for years and years in black segregated schools and then retired about the time of integration. And she was in that courtroom listening, and after I testified and left, she followed me out. And she said, they talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. They talk about Babylon, and we're going to put them to shame.
Absolutely. What bothered me a great deal, Rush, was that the Christian lawyers could not see the relevance of the Bible. They didn't argue that. What they argued was that, the other courses weren't relevant, you know, that chess is not relevant, and therefore it didn't have to be relevant.
They ceded the grounds of the argument.
Exactly, and I don't know why Christian lawyers aren't better versed on these
things.
Why they're
not more literate.
Or more literate. Perhaps they didn't realize that the Bible is relevant to English literature, to archaeology, to ancient history, to Elizabethan English, to mathematics.
Morality. To morality, I mean...
ethics.
If we have no standard, why not kill the judge and the lawyers and go on about our business?
Right.
Considering what you said earlier about the public schools being established specifically to create an anti-religious atmosphere in this country, if that is in fact the purpose of the public schools underlying it all, should we have Bible reading and prayer in public schools?
Well, I think it's Christians have to simply abandon the public schools because, as I said, they can never serve the spiritual or educational needs of Christian children. So why bother to tamper with them? You're going to constantly spend money in court when that money could be used for homeschooling or creating Christian schools. You know, these cases are very expensive. And while the opposition, Norman Lear and his crowd, can get $1 million of legal service free of charge, as they did in these last cases in the creation case, Louisiana creation case, the Tennessee textbook case, the Alabama humanism case. The liberals donate their time, but Christians have to pay through the nose to get legal help in these things. And what happens? We've lost every case now.
Even so, I feel uneasy about the idea of abandoning the field. There are poor people, and people who both have to work, can't take care of, they can't put up a home school thing. And there are people who have disabilities of their own, and so
yes,
forth, so on. And there's an awful lot of millions of lives involved. And sooner or later, we're going to develop cases that we're going to win.
Well, I look at it this way. I attended a homeschooling conference where a black mother got up and said that she works, she'd love to homeschool, but she can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suggested, well, perhaps there are other homeschooling families that could help this lady, you see.
That has been done, I know.
And as soon as the meeting was over, she a bunch of women converged on this mother willing to help. So there are ways of taking care of these things. I'm not saying abandon the children in those schools to simply the Satanists who now run the establishment. I'm simply saying, though, and I have nothing against a Christian teacher who wants to remain in a public school as a missionary. But that Christian teacher should do with his or her eyes open and know what the risks are. But that's all right, you know, there are Christian teachers in the public schools who are trying to do something. But I'm saying, though, that the parents' first responsibility is to their own children to make sure that they get a decent education.
Well, our time is almost over, so I hate to cut it short, but I'm going to have to. I'd like to add just this word. One of the problems with the Christian lawyers is that they're so harried and rushed going from case to case that it's very difficult sometimes to stand back and look at the thing objectively and see the whole thing. They're so hard-pressed, and they simply fight it on this issue and that issue, and are short of funds. They can make more money in other kinds of law. And we do need to develop more resources here so that our lawyers are better able to fight these issues. Well, our time is up. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, Sam. It's been a delight.